said 85, but it was September of 86. She was 85 years old then, but we used to talk shortly before that that we didn't know any other couples our age who still had all four parents still alive and doing reasonably well. And of course, since that time, I lost my father, but her father and my mother are still around. My mother is almost 89, and her father will be 88 this summer. And they both do reasonably well still.
Mm-hmm. And tell us something about your children.
Well, I have three. My oldest is my son, Bill. He'll be 37 years old, Vayizmir, this month. In fact, on the day before Easter, he'll, wait a minute, maybe it is Easter, 25th of March, he'll be 37 years old. He's single. He's never been married. He's a lawyer. He went practices law here in the city. He went to NYU as an undergraduate and then to the Pitt Law School. I have two daughters. My older daughter, Catherine, Kathy, is, well, she's 35 years old. She'll be 36 in November. She lives in Cincinnati. Went to Oberlin, had a graduated with a BA in art history. Then went to Emory, where she got between Emory and the University of Wales in Aberystwyth, got a master's degree in library science. And now that her children are both in school, has gotten a BS and is operating as a nurse at Jewish Hospital in Cincinnati because she wants to become a midwife and is training in midwifery. She's married, as I told you, to a young man named Finkelstein, who's a professor of English at Xavier in Cincinnati. And they have two children, Annie and Stephen. I've been very lucky. Both of my daughters have a boy and a girl. So that that makes it very good. Annie's 10 years old, and Stephen's almost 8. And they're delightful, of course, and we look forward always to seeing them. My youngest child is Margie. She's 32 years old. She lives in Lower Merion, in the outskirts, Philadelphia, actually. She got her undergraduate degree at Grinnell College in Iowa and her master's at Boston University in American Studies. And she's one of those ABDs, all but dissertation for her PhD from Boston, but she's taking time out to have a family, I guess. She has two children, a son who just turned 3 and a daughter who's 8 or 9 months old. And they too are delights. And she's married to a young man named Bruce Goldman from the Chicago area. Norman Finkelstein, Kathy's husband, is from New York City area. Bruce Goldman is a pathologist in the primarily in cardiac pathology at Temple University in Philadelphia, graduate of Northwestern University of Illinois Medical School, and we look forward all the time to seeing them too, and they all get along very nicely so far. Needless to say, very happy that both of my daughters married Jewish boys because that's unfortunately this doesn't always happen. But my children are conscious of their Jewishness, very much like me and Selma. They are primarily ethnic Jews rather than really religious Jews, but they're very conscious of their Jewishness, and they do the Jewish necessaries, as I view it.
Well, what background did you give them in your home?
Well, of course, Anne knows we were out in Eastmont, and we belonged to the congregation there, and they went to Sunday school and did that kind of thing. There was never any religious content in our home.
Was it Reform?
No, not Reform. Atheist. And my children are atheists. There's no two ways about it. But they are Jewish, just as Selma and I, who are confirmed atheists, are Jewish. We don't have anything to do with the Hebrew faith as such. I was incidentally at a bar mitzvah in Detroit a couple of weeks ago. My niece, my grandnephew, was bar mitzvah. And although I am very conscious of the 613 mitzvot, I did not know that there was a 614th, because the rabbi, during the course of his sermon, asked if there was somebody who wanted to perform a mitzvah by furnishing a ride for some gentleman who lived wherever so he can come to shul on Saturday. I didn't know that it would be a mitzvah to give somebody a ride to shul on Shabbos. But now I know that there are 614 mitzvot rather than the standard 613.
So that was the extent of your religion.
Yeah.
How about a hobbies, if any?
I have no hobbies.
You don't paint.
I don't paint. I don't bowl. I don't run. I don't do exercises. I don't swim. I sit and I read, and that's about it. I watch television. I go to the downtown YM, you should excuse the expression, CA, every single day at noon.
Really?
Every day at noon I go. And people tons and spring and do all kinds.
Yeah.
I don't do that. I get undressed. I go to the steam room. I'm a schwitz man.
Oh.
I go to the steam room. I schwitz.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say that, I do a triathlon every day. Steam room, shower, and lounge chair. That's it. And that I do every single day instead of lunch. And it's really wonderful. It takes relax. And I come back to the office and I'm ready for the afternoon. But other than that, I really don't have hobbies. I'm not interested.
Well, you must be interested in your profession. Would you like to say a few words about how is it being a judge? And most important, how did you get into that particular part of law?
Well, when I was just about to finish law school, I was appointed law clerk to a United States District Court Judge, Ray Marsh, here in the Western District of Pennsylvania. That, too, was a kind of a fluke, because I didn't know him, he didn't know me, but he's one of those nuts who's not interested in politics as such. He's interested in hiring people who he thinks will do the job. And what he had was a program where, as he acquired law clerks, as they turned over, one year it was Pitt's turn, the next year it was Duquesne's turn. And this year it happened to be Duquesne's turn. And what his habit was to call the school and tell them to send him someone to interview. The Duquesne Law School's procedure was to offer it to the person who was first in the class academically. And that happened to be me. And so I was sent down to interview with Judge Marsh, who didn't ask me anything about politics or religion or anything. And of course, as by that time I had a wife and three children. And that was in the days when you had to serve a 6-month clerkship before you could be admitted. And generally your preceptor would not pay you any money. And how I was going to serve my clerkship was quite a problem to me. I couldn't be without income for 6 months. And, of course, clerkship with a federal judge would satisfy the clerkship requirement, and I would get paid. So when he asked me if I wanted the job, I asked him if a drowning man wanted air. And that was my introduction to the judiciary. And Ray Marsh is one of those people who can inspire folks. He was just, it's hard to describe that kind of a person. He was interested in doing his job and doing it right. And he would spare no effort to make sure that it was right. And if he asked me to draft a memorandum for him, I had to be able to defend that thing from Genesis to Revelations. He wasn't about to accept it, and he was just outstanding. And I thought, gee, if I could be a judge. Subsequently, I became a law clerk to Henry X. O'Brien, who was first in the Common Police Court and then in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and spent a lot of years with Henry O'Brien, who gave me similar feelings. And he, of course, it became my aim to be a judge, and eventually, there's a line once in a bench bar show that we put on every year, the Allegheny County Bar Association Players. Line in the song was, a judge is a lawyer who knows the governor. Uh-huh. And back in the end of 1972, when there were vacancies on our Court of Common Pleas, then Governor Schapp appointed me to fill one of the vacancies. I've always thought that Milt Schapp was a great man, and that didn't diminish any of my admiration for him.
Well, here's what's curious. How did he come to know about you?
Well, it's, of course, you're active in politics, as I was, in the Democratic Party locally, just as a natural outgrowth of my background. And in addition to that, I had a very close friend who was the governor's legislative liaison at the time, who said a few words to the governor.
Right. But how did you exist working as a law clerk, getting paid or not?
Oh, sure.
Oh, you did get paid.
Of course, and I practiced law.
Well, that's good.
As well, of course.
You had an office.
Of course.
I thought you were just on your own.
Oh, no. I had a law practice, and I practiced law, and I taught at the law school, and I did a number of things.
Oh, you moved around.
Yeah, I had no... earning a living was never a particular problem once I was admitted to the bar. That was no trouble. As a matter of fact, my law clerk work eventually became somewhat of a burden. It was not productive monetarily, right, but I loved it so much that I always hung on to it. It just meant that I had to work a little harder on my private business, that's all. But I've never been a person who had an awful lot of problem getting work done. It's not a burden.
Well, as a result, I'm just asking this to fill in here, are most of your friends in the law business?
Well, I wouldn't say most, but I do have a lot of friends who are lawyers. I have a lot of friends who are physicians, you know, mm-hmm. and probably the people who we see most socially are Stan Hirsch and Charlie Bluestone.
Uh-huh.
And their wives, both of them are physicians. But I have many friends in the law, both on the bench and at the bar. That's a kind of a natural thing, given the business that I've been in for all these years.
Did you ever, or are you ever, involved in any organizations, community stuff?
Yeah, well, I'm on the... Community Relations Committee of the UJF. I have been for many, many years, and I still am. My primary non-professional activity is the American Jewish Congress. Mm-hmm. I'm active in the American Jewish Congress. I have served on the National Governing Council of the American Jewish Congress since 1968, and still do. And I'm, an organization for which I have a great deal of feeling. As you may know, the American Jewish Congress is known, I guess, as the left wing of the Jewish national organizations. That's not really an accurate characterization, but it is the most activist of them. It's engaged most heavily in law and social action. It is the organization which brings the lawsuits in the church-state areas and in the civil rights areas and so forth. And those are subjects in which I am vitally interested and always have been. And it's for that reason that I'm as active as I am in the American Jewish Congress. And I And in addition to that, it gives me a good excuse for spending weekends in New York when Governing Council meets on East 84th Street.
What's on East 84th?
The Congress House, 15 East 84th Street, right between 5th and Madison. And it's a pleasure. Selma can go to the Metropolitan Museum, which is right across the street, while I go to my Governing Council meeting, and we have, and it's a wonderful way to spend a Sunday in New York.
I'm sure. All right. Would you like to touch on your politics?
Politics.
If you're involved in any politics.
Well, I'm not permitted to be involved in any politics anymore. Once you ascend to the bench, you are forbidden by the Code of Judicial Conduct from engaging in any political activity. I can't attend political meetings. I can't make contributions to political candidates or anything of the kind. My background, of course, is as a Democrat. I am not ashamed, as apparently Michael Dukakis was, to brand myself as a liberal Democrat. In fact, politically, I think I could best be characterized as an unreconstructed New Dealer. I know some people I like to call neo-Mensheviks. I'm an unreconstructed New Dealer. I am a liberal Democrat. Philosophically, I do not believe, as Ronald Reagan did, that the government is the problem. I believe that it is the solution and that it is what is necessary for the amelioration of the problems of the people. I don't have any qualms about it. The government doesn't frighten me. The United States Constitution is a brilliant document, and I have no problem whatsoever with placing my reliance on that to give me all the protections that I need from any overly obtrusive government.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to say anything about, I don't know why it's here, I've never asked this before, prohibition? You did talk about the Depression. We have that, mm-hmm. right? You lived through that. They've never asked this question, but I'm asking you.
About prohibition?
Yeah.
Well, prohibition ended when I was about 5 years old, and I've been drinking ever since. That's all I can tell you.
You don't have to say another
word.
It's
been a rare day in many, many years that I haven't had a drink. Don't have any.
I'm glad I asked that, aren't you? Yeah, that was
a good one. I offered you one.
Yes, you did. And I'm proud of you for that. Now, we can't ask you about your business life because you're a judge, and you
yes.
did give us a little of that and what it's like. Did you
what
really
it's like
go
is to
in?
Be underpaid, I can tell you that.
Really? Is that the way you feel?
I feel very keenly that the judges are very underpaid, both federal and state. As you may know, Chief Justice Rehnquist today asked Congress specifically for a 30% increase for the federal judges, which I think is not enough, but okay. You may be interested to know that the Pennsylvania judges make $9,500 less than the United States District Court judges. Hmm. So if they're in bad shape, you can imagine what we are. And my income has been eroded by inflation, although my income has doubled since I've been on the bench. The cost of living has tripled since I've been on the bench. I can't say that Selma and I are in trouble because our children are grown and educated. But if I still had children to educate, I could not afford to remain on the bench.
Then
and obviously, I could make considerably more money in private practice. But I enjoy my life, and I have no intention of doing that. But we ought to get considerably more money.
Well, what do you attribute the fact that you're locked into these particular levels of income?
Well, it's the Pennsylvania General Assembly.
I see.
They won't give anybody raises unless they get them, and they don't have the guts to give them to themselves, so they don't give them to anybody else. Since this is confidential, I will tell you that the problem is that they are basically chazerim.
I know what that word
yeah,
means.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, then, would you say, I had a hot question, and it just eluded me. that the federal increase that was supposed to happen recently wouldn't have touched you?
Oh, no, that wouldn't have had any effect on us at all. Because that was for federal. We're not federal
judges.
Oh,
you're not a federal judge.
We're judges of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We're paid by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Well, I'm glad we got that in there. Right. Yes. I see. So that wouldn't even have touched you.
No.
Did you think they were, they should have gotten the raise?
Unquestionably. Mm-hmm. And so should the members of Congress have gotten the raise. I regret the fact that they did not have the courage to do that which was necessary. But they didn't. And that's it. The same thing has happened in Pennsylvania. We used to have a pay commission. It would make recommendations. The public people would scream their brains out, and the legislature would turn it down, and eventually they did away with the pay commission. Yeah. But there is no good way, no good time. There isn't any. The public, if it were up to the public, the members of the Pennsylvania legislature would still be making $2,500 a year, and the members of Congress would still be making the $6 a day that they were making in 1789.
You feel strongly about that.
Absolutely.
Can I give you the opposite side and hear your reaction to it? In other words, the rank and file, the poor working man, looks at those figures, and they are tremendous figures to a guy that's making $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 a year.
Sure. A guy who's not making it on $20,000 or $30,000 a year doesn't want to hear about somebody who's not making it on $90,000.
That's the trouble.
Well, of course, and that's understandable. But his distorted view of what the market is should not govern what happens. You know, Lee Iacocca got a $16 million bonus last year, and look at the price of a Plymouth. You know, that's not the point. The point is, what does the market dictate? What can lawyers make in private practice? Mm-hmm. When you have a situation where a young man can come out of one of the prestige law schools and clerk for a United States Supreme Court justice, mm-hmm. and then after a couple of years go to work for a New York law firm and earn as much as the United States District United States Supreme Court justice is earning right away, why, it's obviously wrong. How can you attract to the bench the caliber of people who are necessary to perform those very, very important and responsible jobs if you're not willing to pay them? Now, I don't say that judges should make what the Reed Smith partners make, and there's no Reed Smith partner who makes less than $200,000 a year, none. I don't say we should make that, but we ought to be making more than $80,000, given the fact that a kid can come out of law school and go to work for a law firm his very first year and make that kind of money. I mean, it's ludicrous.
Yeah, I'm glad we touched on that. That's in the year, we're talking about that in the year 1989.
That's
for
right.
The record. Okay, I'm glad we touched on that. Next, we have a few words to say, because we're not near the end. We have about 10 minutes. Something you'd like to say about contrasting children, the way you raised them, and the way you were raised. Would you like to comment on that? If not, we can go to something else.
No, I don't know that there was a real significant difference. Our children, we were expected to be responsible when we were children, and we expected our children to be responsible, and they were. I think possibly there was less corporal punishment with respect to my children than there was with respect to me. I don't see any real significant difference in how we were raised. We were expected to be obedient and within reason. We weren't abused. We weren't sat upon. We weren't screamed at. We were respectful and obedient, and our children were too. And without the necessity, I don't think, for a great deal of coercion or causing of emotional trauma or anything of the kind. I really didn't see, at least I don't know, maybe Selma has some other views, but I think the way I was raised is very similar to the way my children were raised. There was always an emphasis on education, on learning. You were expected to do well in school, you know.
Evidently it worked from we see where your children are today.
May I ask a question?
Sure.
Would you talk a bit, Marty, about the things in your career that you're proudest about, that you feel happiest about having accomplished?
Guess what the next question was. How do you view your accomplishments, successes, and failures?
Well,
you're right on target.
I'm basically content with where I am. I enjoy my life very, very much. I like to think that I have the best of all possible worlds, because it's a pleasure to go to work in the morning and it's a pleasure to come home in the evening. Now, there aren't many people who can say that.
Yes, all right.
There are so many people who literally hate what they have to do to earn a living, but they have to do it. They have to provide the wherewithal. Well, when you do something that gives you satisfaction, that gives you fulfillment, and nevertheless pays you, gives you what it takes to get along, why, you're in great shape. And then if you can come home and be happy as well, why,
you got it made.
You have it all. I'm pleased with our situation. Selma and I have had a good life. We haven't lacked for anything materially or emotionally or intellectually. We have what we need. I was able to complete my education under somewhat difficult circumstances, and I'm proud of that. I admit to pride in the fact that I was able to go to law school and graduate first in my class and succeed, even though I was a long time coming to it. And failures, I mean, who's to say what are failures? Maybe I should have concentrated on making $250,000 a year. Maybe that's a failing, but I don't view it that way. We have been happy. We enjoy our lives, we enjoy our friends, I think we have a full and complete life. The only thing I have to complain about is that it's going to end.
No control over that, huh? If you found a way to handle that, we'd like to hear it.
No, I don't know how to do that. I've often said that if there's anything to reincarnation, all I want to do is come back as Selma's second husband.
And then, beautiful.
And then everything will be all right.
What about your sense of the city as you've been a part of its growth and change, Marty? What do you see?
Well, of course, the city isn't growing, unfortunately. It is contracting and very severely. And I regret that. I'm a city person. You know, I spent all those years out in the East Hills in Eastmont, but I was really never happy there. I don't like to walk willingly on anything softer than asphalt. I'm a city person, basically. I'm not a suburban country person. I regret the fact that the city is diminishing as it is diminishing, but this part of the city, of course, as you know, shady side and East Oakland, the part of the city, is really
Squirrel Hill.
Yeah, it's a wonderful area in which to live. We can walk to the museum. We can walk over to CMU to the plays. We can walk into Shady Side. We can walk to the Playhouse. And in general, walk around in this beautiful level area of the city where. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a reasonably safe area. We don't have any concerns about being bothered and so forth. And I regret the fact, as I say, that the city itself is contracting, and I'm hoping that somehow we can find the political wisdom and courage to do what is necessary to revitalize the city. But that's a tough thing to do. There's going to have to be massive legislative changes. There's going to have to be something done to ameliorate the tax-exempt property status of so much of the city. There's going to have to be something. I know that one of the filthy words that's said around here is metropolitanism, but really there's no justification for having certain of our independent municipalities who are in court constantly to get the special relief so they can raise their taxes above what they're permitted to have by legislation, because they can't exist. They don't have the tax base, but they insist upon having their independence and their own police and their own tax collectors, and it costs a fortune. Somehow they got it through in Philadelphia with the city-county consolidation, and something like that, it seems to me, is really essential in Allegheny County as well, but I don't expect to live long enough to see it.
You know that... No, there's one more. How do you view Pittsburgh's Jewish life and its place in the general community now?
Well, I think Pittsburgh has a very busy and active Jewish life. If anything, it's over-organized. We have a lot of very, very busy and active Jewish organizations and congregations, and I think it fits in very well with the general community. One thing you can say about the...